Welcome to today's episode of the First Moves podcast. We'll be speaking to Sebastian Nierup, usually my co-host, about him and his company Unshackled. We'll be talking about how his personal irritation led to innovation and how he's building a team around shared values to make this a reality. Beyond that, we'll also be talking about the roller coaster of entrepreneurship, especially in the early days, but also how these experiences reshape our definition of success. If you want to learn how you can build a company with global potential, then make sure you keep listening. We hope you enjoy the episode. Sebastian, welcome to the show. Usually you're joining me on the side of the table interviewing our guests, but today it's going to be a little bit different.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So I know you quite well by now, but I think it would be nice if you give a bit of a general introduction to yourself first, who you are, and maybe what you're doing currently.
Yeah, for sure. My name is Sebastian Nierup. I'm currently 23. I grew up in the Netherlands. I have two Danish parents. So I grew up in a Danish household in the Netherlands. I was born close to Maastricht and lived here pretty much my whole life. I studied in high school at the United World College here in Maastricht, so an international school, everything in British. And I, after that, went on to study at the university here in Maastricht, where I did my bachelor's in international business. Met a lot of Germans on that study, as everyone who studies in Maastricht know. A lot of good friends there as well. And then currently I'm studying managerial decision-making and control as part of my master program. And I have a little side hustle on the side that's called Unshackled.
I don't think the side hustle is that small, but could you maybe tell us a bit about what Unshackled is and maybe also how it started?
Yeah, for sure. So starting from the beginning, I met my girlfriend in 2021, and during one of the first, I met her in August, and we started properly dating in October. And one of the first walks we had, when it was cold outside, I looked, I tried to grab her hand, and it was super cold. So I looked down, and it was completely blue and purple. And at first, it's like this kind of reaction of concern, like, "Well, is something wrong?" "Oh no, I just have Raynaud's," she said. And I looked at her and I was like, "Raynaud's?" And as probably many of the listeners right now as well, they're also going to go, "Raynaud's, what the hell is that?" But as any person who is interested in entrepreneurship, I went home with a Google, with a good old laptop, Google Raynaud's syndrome. And then it turns out that roughly 20% of the world population actually suffers from Raynaud's or have the syndrome in their bodies. And I was like, "Nah, that can't be true." And then I checked some other sources, and yeah, it was true that one in five people actually have it. Now, there's a difference between having it and then the symptom showing. So real market size is roughly between 3% and 4% of all adults in the world suffer from Raynaud's to such an extent that they would actually need something to help them with it. Real quick, Raynaud's, for the people who don't know, is a capillary disease in which you, when you're in contact with the cold, you get very much pain in your fingers, your feet, anything that sticks out in your body, so the body's extremities. As your capillaries, they narrow down and kind of just make the blood flow go back into your inner organs to kind of keep them warm. We all have that mechanism, but when you have Raynaud's, it's 10 times heavier than if you're a normal person, I guess you can call it. So I went home to Google. We bought 30 different kind of gloves that are on the market. I tested them with my girlfriend, with some other people from the university that I knew had Raynaud's, and none of them really worked. And that's when I knew, okay, that might actually be something. And I did all of this before I registered the company and before I even started working on it as a company, because 9 out of 10 businesses, they actually die off because there's no customer for your product. And I just wanted to make sure that I didn't make that mistake. So many people have told me that that's a mistake to be made. And I was like, okay, I'm not doing that. I'm trying to, it might still happen, but I'm just trying to make sure that I know as much as I can before going into this. And that's how the company started. We registered in September 2022 with Campbell van Koophandel.
Beautiful. And so you tested, like you said, lots of these different gloves. What then came out of those tests into the product that you're developing today?
So a lot of them claim that they work for Raynaud's. And one of the stupidest ones we found is this silver lining gloves, they call them. And there's no heating in them or anything like that. Like, our gloves have a battery and they heat up with electricity. But these gloves, they take the temperature from your hand, like the heat that your hand gives free, and puts it back onto your hand again. So you kind of get this insulating factor of air in between. It's a little bit like a wetsuit. Like when you get the water in, you heat up the water that's in between the wetsuit and you. The only thing is, when you have Raynaud's, there's no heat in the hand. So there's no heat coming off your hand. So this is probably one of the products that we got the most comments on being like, why is this even something that works for this? And that's when we realized that it's very important that the fingertips are also included and the bottom of the hand is also included in the heating. Most of the heated gloves right now, they're A, massively expensive. Our gloves are also going to be quite pricey in the end because it's so expensive to develop everything. But they're very pricey and they only heat up the top of the hand. And that's the one we want to switch around and make sure everything of the hand is heated.
And top of the hand, you just mean on top of the palm?
Yeah. So on top of the palm, some of them, they go into the fingers as well, but only on top of the fingers. A lot of them don't have the heating on the bottom because it's difficult to make the lining inside with the heating when you need to grab certain cups or materials outside.
Right. And so basically what Unshackled is doing is making gloves that you can use, I think the word is like dexterously.
Yeah.
And still heat the hands completely. Yes. And totally.
Yeah. Right. So we're trying to make the gloves in such a way that they would work for multiple different market groups. So the people who have Raynaud's, it would alleviate their symptoms a little bit. So we can't claim that because we don't have a medical registration on it, but we're working on seeing how we can get that done. Then we also will sell the gloves to recreational users, such as people who go skiing, because the gloves are made almost paper thin. So you can use them as an inner lining glove into your skiing gloves. So you don't need to buy new heating skiing gloves. You can use the ones you buy here. For that already, we are looking right now to see if we work with the military as well with them. So yeah, there's a different market segments that could work with the glove as well.
I mean, I already know the business a bit, but I think when you start to explain more and more, you can see that the use case could be almost anyone in a colder climate or cold environments, because it could also be inside, not only outside, right?
Yes.
So I think that there's a lot of potential there, but I also know from our conversations that it's not so easily done. So you start at a very different place as to where you are now. Can you maybe walk us through that process of maybe some of the bigger roller coasters you've had, so to speak, over that time that you've run Unshackled?
Yeah, so the roller coaster has been very much downwards, with very steep upward slopes again that brings you up to the top again and then goes really fast down again. In the beginning, it was just me in the company because I was a little bit naive, thinking, I can do this myself. Why do I need other people? And all these different kind of things that you do when you're young. And then I realized, actually, we started off with wanting to make it medical. I started off wanting to make it a medical product only for Raynaud's, because that's what my girlfriend had. And I had set my mind on it had to help my girlfriend, her family. And then as it turned out, my own family also suffers from Raynaud's. Some of my aunts have it, my grandparents have it. Not so weird when one in five people have it, but I just didn't know about it. But I really had my mind set on making it medical. That kind of got shattered to the point where I didn't even know if the company was going to continue anymore, because I talked to some specialists within the university hospital here in Maastricht and some of the clinical research teams. And then we got into the point of how much is this going to cost? And the price that we've gotten has been swinging from one party to the other. One says it's 300,000, the other one says it's 2.5 million euros. So it's a very, very big spread on what people say it's going to cost to get this done. And then we started making the calculations whether it's going to be profitable to actually invest in the medical certification. We still haven't gotten an answer to that properly yet. We're still trying to figure it out. But then we started actually working together with an engineering company, because I said, I don't care if it's going to be medical or not. We still need to get something out. And they started working together with an engineering company. And I didn't read the contract properly in the beginning. So it was a budgetary price of around 7,000 euros. And they called me up saying, hey, we have reached the money. We need more. And I had applied for a grant that would be 50% of the entire R&D money. And I applied for the price that I got, which was 7,000 euros. So I got 3,500 euros from the government institution here in Limburg. And then I called them up and I was like, hey, the price is going to change. Oh, yeah, no, that's not our problem. That's, you applied for this one, so that's how it's going to be. And the final price ended up being close towards 15,000 euros, and that all came out of my own pocket in the end. So that's one of those really big, steep downwards slopes. And the product that we received from the engineering team also was not very favorable. Now, then I got a contact to the to one of the persons in the European Investment Bank and had a meeting with him. And the money that they were not even able to give, but that like you can apply for, it's way too much than what we need. And there's way too many obligations to it. And this is something you do when you have a not a startup anymore, but a scale up and or an SME where you really have that kind of power behind you to say, okay, we will take this loan for 10 million and we will be able to pay it back within the next 10 years. We can't say that now because it's way too much money for us to handle. But he then referred me to a company in Sweden called InuHeat. And this is then where we got our first product prototypes developed because they actually specialized in heated clothing. And they sell the technology for inside the gloves. And this is where we had the biggest issues. I'm a business person. I have no engineering capabilities whatsoever. So we then used a Swedish company to make the first prototypes that we could then go test with people. And we just now received an R&D subsidy to make our own technologies for the gloves now.
Yeah, that's quite a ride. I think also it's hindsight is always a beautiful thing where you could say, you know, this is why we're here.
It's always easy to say it in hindsight. I should have done that.
Absolutely. But I think hearing your story, it's also like, yeah, it sounds like with the first engineering company, it was almost a waste of 15,000 euros. So
the thing is, the company, they were super sweet to me and they were really helpful and they were really working nicely together with me. It was just that I didn't read the contract properly. So the mistake, it's on my part because I read through it afterwards as well and had a lawyer read through it and was like, yeah, this is normal. I just didn't know. I had no one to advise me on that at that time. So right. It's no one else's fault but me.
Yeah, I think those are the tough lessons that you learn along the way. How do you think your mindset has changed going through these things when challenges do pop up?
One of the things is cash is always a problem. The people who say you can start a startup and get it going with 100 euros, I really don't believe in it at all. You need to have some kind of capital, whether it's 1,000 or 2,000 bucks. You won't get far with that, but you can get somewhere. I've also learned that when seeking for funding in the beginning, it's extremely difficult if you don't have any kind of product to show it yet. And to get a product to show it yet, you have to invest quite a bit of money. If it's a hardware, at least you're looking at 10 to 15,000 euros before you have something proper, unless you're extremely skilled yourself in programming and engineering and you can sew stuff. But most people don't have the machines for that. So you end up needing a large sum of money in the beginning anyway. That's probably one of the biggest lessons that I can look back on and be like, okay, if you start another company now, make sure you have some money first. And it's not just to burn it, but in the beginning, if you really start off, you're gonna make mistakes. And some of those mistakes are going to be with money. Whether you want to do it or not, most of us don't. But it's going to happen, unfortunately. And then you just kind of got to deal with it when it happens. And then, yeah, you got to figure it out. And I did. It made me very broke for a couple of months, where I really had to switch around every single coin I had. Now it's fine again. So you recover from it again if you just deal with it properly.
Yeah, I think that capacity to recover is almost entrepreneurship 101. But I think something else is also learning. And I think something that is very useful to have is taking past experiences with you, which is something you do inside your company, but also beyond that. And so before starting Unshackled, you had flipped burgers at McDonald's, you'd worked at the post office, delivered pizzas, and also worked in sales at T-Mobile. So I'm curious, what lessons did you take from there already when you were starting Unshackled?
So the McDonald's job was something I did when I was 14 or 15 years old back in the day. On Sundays, work for absolutely no money at all per hour. But it did teach me, though, that it's not always the job that defines whether you're going to be happy or not, it's the people you work with. Because I had some really good people I worked with at McDonald's. The job was not very nice, to be honest. Flipping burgers, standing in this very warm environment, you can't sit down, so you have like 2-3 hours before you get a break, and then you have to stand and your back hurts and it's slippery and all this kind of stuff. It's not the nicest place to work, but the environment was quite nice to work in. I wouldn't go back there again, but it was a good experience to take with me. Then going to the probably the most labor-intensive job I had was working for the post, because I was biking around. That also really sucked when it was raining. And then I stepped it up a bit when I went to the pizza delivery, because there I started as the first delivery person in the restaurant. One of my friends got me the job, and then he joined later on as well. But we kind of built together the department for the delivery for the restaurant. So that was a bit more of the responsibility then. And that's when I knew, okay, I like the responsibility. Then unfortunately got an injury that I couldn't work for them anymore. And then I got quite, I wouldn't say depressed, but I was very down for a while. I couldn't do this. I was playing American football at the time as well. Couldn't do that anymore. So I was like, ah, shit, what am I going to do now? I had surgery, was home for a couple of weeks and everything. And then I saw online T-Mobile, salesperson. I had zero sales experience. I didn't know what I was doing. I applied for it. And I remember the job interview, the manager, he looks at me and asks me, what is your sales experience? I have none. I remember his face looking at me as like, how did you even get this interview if you have no sales experience? I looked at him, I don't know. I applied and here I am. So then he actually hired me, and they were really good at training me into using the systems and everything. So I kind of got my landing space there quite quickly, and got quite quickly to grips with everything, how everything worked. And then it was just starting to talk to people. And the biggest lesson I learned there was talking to people. How do you deal with customers that aren't happy? And even if it's something you have no control over and you can't even fix it for them in the shop, yeah, how do you deal with them being super aggressive sometimes even and pissed at you? And it was just all about keeping calm. But it's also about thinking on your feet. And I sometimes feel like if I, now at Unshackled, when I'm in a business meeting and someone throws me a curveball, I can see myself mentally going, okay, switch around and then hit it at this angle. So that's the T-Mobile job that's really helped me stay agile and really thinking on my feet.
I think another thing also is the way you've built a team at Unshackled. And from the lesson you learned at your time at McDonald's of surrounding yourself with the right people, how has that gone into your process for building the team?
Yeah, so I'm fortunate to have pretty good advisors in the company. And when I got to the point of like, this is getting a little much for me now, I was doing 90-hour weeks trying to get stuff running around, and half of the time was just empty time chasing people that didn't even answer to me or anything like that in the end, and also financing people. And I was like, okay, now it's time to get some people on board here. So I set up some calls with advisors and asked them, how do you do this? And they all looked at me and said, everyone has a different method. You got to find yours. And I remember I kind of left the call and thinking, well, thank you for pretty much nothing on that one, because how do I find my way if I don't know how to start? So I went to LinkedIn. As a business student, LinkedIn is our gold. And I really just tried to see who's out there. I was looking for a marketing person at this time. And I didn't even know if I should text them or just connect with them. So I connected with this person called Martin Pavicic from Zuid University, also here in Maastricht, and he had done a major in marketing, exactly what I was looking for. So I connected with him and kind of was like, maybe something is going to come out of this, and didn't really think more to it, and then just kind of left it. A couple of days later, I get a message from him saying that he's been looking at the company and he thinks that the mission is super interesting, if we could have a meeting maybe. So I took a meeting with him, and before I knew it, I actually hired him, and he helped me set up the first the Kickstarter campaign that unfortunately wasn't successful. And then from hiring him, it kind of just had this snowball effect. And I honestly don't know what happened, but we received 118 applications until now of people wanting to work for the company. And I honestly don't know what we've done right. Obviously, it's something. We have to analyze, seeing what did we actually do right. But we turned down a lot of people as well because we just didn't have the space for it and the capacity. And then for our engineer, it was Martin's special sauce that got him in. I don't know. he has a special way with words and a way of connecting with people that just is amazing. So he actually found our engineer that we have on board now at the RWTH in Aachen. So Piyush, great guy as well. And we've talked in previous meetings as well with advisors about my values. So I have a business coach and a personal coach that's the dad of one of my good friends, and he's offering me free help with that. And he was also saying, you got to see what are your values and how do you portray that into the team, and how does the team's values need to align with the company values, which are essentially my values. And I rely a lot on honesty, telling people it straight up, be like, okay, I fucked up. Just tell me straight away instead of waiting with it. And then 2 weeks later, I kind of fucked this up. Okay, that's why we lost this client, or that's why we lost this connection. No, just tell me straight up so we can mend it immediately. So during the interviews we have with people, we kind of just played in on this, the transparency, honesty, resilience, teamwork, all these different kind of things. And based on that, we hired people to the team we are now.
I like that approach, but I think there's one question I have, which is it's very hard to interview people based on their values. Because if you say, oh, at Unshackled, we value honesty, what about you? As a very basic question. Of course, people would just say, yeah, I love, I'm obviously, super honest.
Obviously, yes.
So how do you test that within the people you're talking to?
So that was the first question I had to my my business coach as well. It's how do we tackle this? Because honestly, it's what you just said. If we say, okay, we value honesty in our company. Oh, but I'm very honest. That's the first thing people are going to say. They're going to try to play you on that. And then 2 weeks later, you're going to find out they're not very honest at all. And he actually gave me one of the best advice I've had until now on hiring people. It's you make up a little scenario, and then you tell that scenario to the person you're interviewing, and then you see how they would react in the scenario. So it's also not bulletproof either, but it's better than just saying we value honesty. So you could have a scenario saying, okay, you walk into the office and you see papers on the table and you spilled coffee on one of them, and do you throw it in the bin or do you go say, I'm so sorry, I spilled coffee all over your papers and this is a contract for millions or something like that. And then you see how they would react to it on the spot as well. I mean, there you can also think that people would just say, I'll obviously tell you. But you can usually see on their body expression whether or not they're actually telling the truth or not. So that's kind of how we filter these different things out of it. And that's also, it's difficult setting the questions up. It took some time in the beginning, but the questions you can reuse again in a later interview.
Yeah, I think that would be my like next thing is like, how do you make sure that those questions aren't biased to predispose people to answer in a certain way?
Trial and error.
Exactly. And then using those questions consistently. I think it's a big thing. But I think that almost scientific approach, it also leads me to my next question. Because your team, you've built them from people, like you said, from the university. But at the same time, you've recently posted on your LinkedIn that there's this gap between academia and actually running a business. So I get this gap. I've experienced it. But I'd like to get your thoughts about this. Yeah,
so my thoughts on it is that academia is extremely important. Also just because you have all these social media influence people right now. Also, especially Americans say you don't need to go to university to become rich. Very true. You don't need to. But university does give you a step in between where you learn how to research. All these academic articles that you have to read during your studies where everyone says, oh, we'll never remember these. True, you probably will never remember them. But you do learn how to read an abstract. See, is this paper interesting or not? Or how do you go through with this? How do you write a paper? Writing is a big skill that I didn't know you needed as much as you do when it comes to business. All these applications you have to fill in, grant proposals, everything that just takes hours and hours and hours of writing, where university has helped a lot with that. University also helps you make all the building blocks that you need to kind of build up the foundation of your company. And especially here at Maastricht, where we do PBL, you really have this hands-on learning effect where, yeah, for those who don't know, PBL is problem-based learning, where you get a real case in the world, and then you kind of use the theory you learned to solve the problem, essentially. So this has really helped a lot, but there's a big but. It's theory. And a lot of the books are theory, and you can look at other company scenarios. It's still theoretical because that's their company, that's not your company. So that's really what I mean with the gap between academia and then practice, is this gap with the theoretical knowledge that you get and you look at other companies, and then what actually happens in your company. I didn't learn at university how to deal with these kind of contract readings for engineers, for example. But I did learn how to handle finances and accountancy, and how to do organizational behavior and a little bit of management and a little bit of marketing in between it all. So I got the building blocks for that. But then when it comes to all the legal issues, we didn't have a single course on legal things in the company. Neither did we have a course, because we're mastering this in the Netherlands and growing up here, so I knew a little bit about it, but we didn't have any course on how do you actually take the first step towards making a company. How do you actually register? So you have to go to the KVK. No one told me that. That took me a long time to figure out. I started a BV, so limited liability company, which is a besloten vennootschap in Dutch. And I didn't know that you had to go to a notary office in the Netherlands to do this first. So first I tried online to apply. And then I got an email saying you have to go to the notary's office, which you have to pay for, first of all, quite a bit. And then that gets sent on to the government. None of these things were taught in at university. We also had to kind of find our own way to the Center of Entrepreneurship and Innovation here in Maastricht. That's kind of, you have to find everything yourself a little bit. And that's where I mean the mismatch between actual university studies and then the practice, or the theory and practice come from. Hope that answers the question.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, part of it is also just the fundamental difference that you have between them.
Yeah.
That probably will never be bridged, because you're not actually starting a company as part of a course of university. But I get that there is also this difference between it being someone else's company and your own company. So, I mean, Sebastian, we're putting all these puzzle pieces together. There's the team you've built, the kind of roller coaster that has kind of gotten you here as well. And we've spoken about this in private, but we've noticed that when you have the blend of something that's innovative, something that's new, as Unshackled is doing, plus something that's doable and financially very interesting, you get a lot of praise and excitement from your environment. How was that experience at the beginning, and how has that changed over time?
There's a drastic difference from the beginning to now. So in the beginning, when I first started and people said, what a great idea, this is amazing, this is going to become something, you go back with this feeling of like you're the king of everything. Like, oh my God, yes, I haven't made any money yet, but shit, we're getting there. And this is going to go really fast. And in a couple of months, this is really fun and this is really good. And we have a number of employees and la, 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 la. And then 2 months go by, 3 months go by, 4 months go by. And all you still get is, ah, this is so great. This is amazing. La, 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 la. And still nothing happens. And then we did the university challenge here in Maastricht. We actually made it to the finals. And I remember one of the members that we actually needed some money from actually came to me afterwards, because we weren't chosen to be one of the two final ones to pitch in the end. And he said, you will make it because you're a great company. And I just thought to myself, what do you mean we'll make it? I mean, you will make it, yes, if we get your money. But we were in such a tight spot where we couldn't really go any further without money, because we needed to order the first inventory. And I just looked at him as like, what do you mean by this? Oh yeah, because you're great, I believe in you. And I was like, okay. I was a little bit like, oh, that sounds actually quite nice in the beginning. And I remember going to my dad and Martin. They were standing at the table because my dad came to watch me pitch. And I told him that. And I just remembered Martin's face just kind of like hang down and be like, what? Why are these people all saying this? Because it doesn't cost them anything to say anything, but they never put their money where their mouth is at. And that's kind of the lesson through all of this, is that so many people will come to you and give you shoulder pats and everything, but in the end, not much is going to come from that. You might be a lucky company that where you get one appraisal and then they give you money in the end as well. But we've noticed a shift in that recently, because we recently got the subsidy then for R&D. And as soon as you start telling these financing institutions that now the government has given you money, then all of a sudden the appraisals become more of a, let me connect you to this guy within my organization. And that's a guy we haven't had access to before. So we have had access to people within the organization, but that's more like the front line. And now you start getting access to people in the back room. And that's when it starts becoming really interesting now. But it's really about that first money. If there is no money on the table yet, then a lot of these institutions, they're going to pull back. But as soon as the first money comes in, then they're going to be like, okay, there's already one institution going into this. Then we might follow because it's a bit more secure now that someone else is in it as well. Same with investors. Once you get that first angel investor, people, I wouldn't say they're going to line up, but people are going to ask, who's your lead investor? This guy. Okay, that's good. Here we go. We're going to vet you and then we go.
I think for sure those things tend to like domino on top of one another. But it also sounds like your definition of success has changed as a result. At least when I relate it to my own story, it's very much when you first get that praise, I'm onto something, this is it, we're going to make it. And then there's the gap in between. And that's when the definition starts to change. How has your definition of success changed through that experience?
So as any 20-year-old starting a company, looking on Instagram, let's get rich quick. And then move to Dubai and drive around Ferraris. That was kind of the initial goal for success. And then I met my girlfriend before. So this was before I met my girlfriend that I already had that I wanted a company just to make money. And my girlfriend just really does not care about money or materialistic things. It's more about how do you feel as a person and are you in good relationships and are you in trustworthy? Are you around trustworthy people? That's more important than having 2 yachts and 14 houses and whatnot. So that already shifted my success a little bit. I still had that a little bit in the back of like, oh, a Porsche would be nice and these kind of things. And then I started the company and then very small things became small steps towards success. So then you got that one connection and then you went into the meeting with them and you got a second meeting with them and you're like, oh shit, that's great. And it very quickly becomes not about money. The connections you make with people are more important than the money you could make on the short term. So the long term becomes more in picture than the short term. And that's, I guess, what the definition of success has changed a little bit for me as well. I've also talked to Giuseppe, the owner of Sicilery. We're also like, he's like a perfectionist that success doesn't really happen. You can be successful without having success. And I've really reflected on that after talking to him. And I actually think it's a little bit the same with me. The line is always going to get shifted from being having success. The company can be successful, but for you to feel success, it's always going to change to a certain extent. Because then you become 10 people that are paid in the company. Okay, then you become 20. We can hit 50. We can hit 100. And it's going to keep on like this. But as of right now, what I would say is the company being successful and me personally being successful is being able to pay my guys a good salary for making their efforts worthwhile with the company. That's really what my definition of success would be. And then it's them before me in this scenario.
And then when you zoom out a bit further, because this is your next goalpost, so to speak, but really what you're trying to build with Unshackled is something bigger. How do you kind of see the next few years panning out? What steps are you working to make to get there?
So the big milestones that we're trying to hit right now is definitely getting our own technology. So we're good on the way for that. Our CTO is doing an amazing job at developing our own technologies right now. And then we want to patent that. And then we're definitely looking on getting the first big investor, private investor, not a government, on board as well. And then just starting to make sales. That's the big next steps, at least for us. And then later on, we're looking obviously to get international as well with the company. Adding new products and all these different kind of things that you get with growth.
So speaking of this shift in mindset and also the direction in which you want to go, what do you think the world of business and entrepreneurship needs more of?
less of listening to Instagram and TikTok.
Why?
Yeah, so I think a lot of young people at the moment, and you know this as well from the mental health perspective, but also from like a business perspective, a lot of people, they get depressed or they feel bad about themselves. I've had that myself as well, where you open Instagram and then you see this 19-year-old or 20-year-old guy on a yacht throwing around a bunch of $100 bills and having his time of his life, and he only works 1 hour a day. And he's doing this faceless YouTube channel or whatnot. And yes, it works for some people, but it never only takes 1 hour a day unless you have a massive amount of people behind you that take care of everything for you. And I think that these kind of people, they have been normalized a little bit now in society that, oh, that's normal that you as a 20-year-old have a net worth of 4 or 5 million or maybe even 10 or 20 million. And it's not. It really isn't. And I came across this post the other day where it mentioned how much net worth you should have per age to be considered very rich, or rich like in the top one percentile. And as a 22-year-old, it's only 22,000 euros in your net worth. So not even cash in the bank, just like your net worth, which is not a crazy amount of money when you think about it to be considered in that 1%. So I think the business world just needs to be a bit more like, set your own goals and maybe don't listen so much to what others are doing, because 99% of the time, these people are also just trying to sell a course. And 99% of the time, the Lamborghini they're driving around in is leased, either for the week or for the month or for the day only. Some people only lease it for the day to make the videos and then say, buy my course to become financially free in the next month and make a million in the first year or something like that. And it's super easy to hide that on Instagram because it's just a video. You have no chance of seeing what's going on behind it. And that's, yeah. There was a clip on the Dutch news not all too long ago with grandparents calling in and saying that her son wanted to start dropshipping. And it's also something I thought a lot about when I was younger, dropshipping. For those who don't know, I think most people do know what dropshipping is, but it's buying something somewhere and selling it for more money on your website kind of thing. And I've never been able to morally get myself to do that, because you're buying something from AliExpress or Alibaba for 20 cents and you sell it on for 10 or 20 euros onwards. And in my opinion, you're pretty much just ripping off people. I've never been able to do that. And I remember these grandparents saying, is this a legit business our grandson is getting into? And then these news people were talking about what it was and all these kind of things. And the answer actually got into, it's not really a sustainable business model. It's something to make quick money here and there, and then it's not something that in 15 years is still there. Now, that's what I'm trying to do with Unshackled. I'm really trying to build this longer lasting organization that's really going to be there in 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years. Maybe even my kids and my grandkids, maybe the company still would be there. That's a little bit the goal that we're trying to build. It takes a lot longer time to do. It's a lot more work involved in it, and a lot more work where you don't really see the reward immediately. And I think that's also the problem. People want to see rewards immediately. Like, I put this work in and next week I want to see some money come in for it. And I think that's the shift in mindset that we need in business at the moment.
And it also sounds like you're speaking of a tension between money and something else. What is that something else for you?
Fulfillment, I guess, you could say, because you can make a lot of money and not feel fulfilled. I've met a lot of people who are very wealthy, but they hate their life. It's they're doing something that they don't really believe in, but it's making them a lot of money. So why stop it, right? Why stop the money printing machine if you have it at home? And a lot of them, then when you ask them, so what would you want to do? I kind of just want to go back to being in a startup team where we are 4 or 5 people who work 24/7 together, have a super tight friendship, super tight bond. But I don't want all these money or all these people chasing me for money. So I think it's the fulfillment, that's the other part. So you can do the chasing the money part and really just trying to become rich. We're all trying to make money. There's no secret in that. You don't start a company to become broke. You start a company to make money with it. I'm also doing this to make money and make a living out of this. But there's a difference between becoming very rich and just wanting to be able to survive, I guess. If you become very rich from it, that's what happens. But if you start seeking that only, I don't think you're going to get there, because you're going to make decisions that are on the short term making you money, but on the long term might come and bite you in the ass afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also depends on the frame, of course, because you can make long-term decisions to make money. But I think for a lot of people, they usually need or want another kind of fuel as well. And I think what's hard is how to not indeed listen to or follow the voices externally of that's what success looks like.
Yes.
And that's what I need to have to even feel
and that's very okay difficult
in the first place. Exactly. And you also don't know where those people started.
I have no idea.
Yeah. So they might be trust fund babies or what have you who are just selling a course for some side cash. I don't know. But I never know their person. So I think judgment is not per se the right thing to have, especially when it comes to comparing yourself to them.
For sure. And that's also what I learned from you don't know what happened to the people on Instagram. But when you talk to someone in real life who has done that or has a dad who has done something and they are actually the trust fund baby, you get a whole different perspective of what's actually going on. Because social media is also a big lie for a lot of people.
All right, Sebastian. I mean, you know this better than anyone, basically. But on this podcast, we have a closing tradition.
Yes.
Where we ask the guest to bring a object of personal value. Yes. What did you bring and why?
So I actually brought two things with me, and there are two books. One of them is a Danish book called Entrepreneur, when we translate it. And it's about two entrepreneurs who wrote a book about what they learned from starting 30 different companies. That's a lot. When I was little, I always got told, you can only start one thing. You will never be able to do more. And when I read this book, I think my parents gave it to me once because I got excited about entrepreneurship. And when I read it, I got this mentality of like, oh, so in the beginning, you focus on one, and then later on, you can start taking more. So this is kind of what fueled my passion as well for entrepreneurship, I guess you can say. And then the second book that I have, it's written by Grant Cardone. Real estate finance person from the United States called the 10X rule. And it's pretty much that if you do anything 10 times more than you're doing right now, you will get there at some point. You will see progress at some point. No matter if you're going to the gym and you're doing it 10 times more heavily than you're doing it now, you will see a result. If you're writing email marketing and you're doing it 10 times more than you're doing now, you will see a result in the end. And that's really where my eyes opened up to, that it's not just about being lucky. It's also about hard work. So that's also one of those motivating factors where I also show this to my team sometimes and say like, okay, we're in a tough period right now. Let's just go at it even harder so we're done with it quicker. That's also one of the messages from the book. So those are the objects I brought with me.
All right. Beautiful, Sebastian. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.